Welcome to Sci-Fi on Screen, the podcast that goes where no podcast has gone before. We here at Sci-Fi on Screen take a deep, close look at your favorite genre movies of science fiction, horror, fantasy, and comic book land. We go deep, scene by scene. We do comparisons of originals and remakes, and special shows. Just ahead, a new episode. And thanks for listening. Welcome back to another episode. This week we're going to be tackling a classic of sci-fi, John Carpenter's Escape from New York. And I am a huge fan of this movie. It's a seminal film for me growing up. People my age in their mid to late 40s. It was quite the mind blower when we first saw it. There was nothing else like it really that had come before it. And I'm excited to talk about it. A little bit of background about Escape from New York. I didn't find too much. You know, Carpenter is terminally tight-lipped about many things. I went to see him in an interview once at the Directors Guild of America after seeing Ghosts of Mars, and, you know, he might as well have been a plumber up there for the amount of enthusiasm and explanatory excitement that he had towards the craft. You know, he's very famous for that. He originally wrote the screenplay for Escape to New York in 1976, he says, in the aftermath of the Watergate scandal, and he says, quote, "The whole feeling of the nation was one of real cynicism about the president. I wrote the screenplay and no studio wanted to make it because, according to Carpenter, it was too violent, too scary, too weird," end quote. He had been inspired by the film Death Wish, which was very popular at the time, and although he did not agree with the film's philosophy, he liked how it conveyed, quote, "the sense of New York as a kind of jungle, and I wanted to make a science fiction film along those lines." Avco Embassy Pictures, the film's financial backer, preferred either Charles Bronson or Tommy Lee Jones to play the role of Snake Plissken, and Carpenter immediately chose Kurt Russell. And Russell was trying to overcome his years of making Disney movies when he was a teen in his early 20s. Strongest Man in the World, Herbie the Love Bug, he made all these Disney TV movies. Or actually, maybe they went to full screen. I just remember them seeing on the Wonderful World of Disney on Sunday nights. So Carp kind of held his ground. He refused to cast Bronson on the grounds that he was too old, and he was worried that he could lose directorial control over the picture with an experienced actor. Eventually, the studio agreed to Kurt Russell, and Russell says he used a rigorous diet and exercise program in order to develop a lean, muscular build and endeavored to stay in character between takes and throughout the shooting, as he welcomed the opportunity to get away from the Disney comedies he had done previously. He did find it necessary to remove the eye patch between takes, as wearing it seriously affected his depth perception. So Carpenter had made Dark Star, but no one wanted to hire him as a director, so he assumed that he would make it in Hollywood as a screenwriter. So he went on to do a bunch of other films with the intention of making Escape later. And of course, after the success of Halloween, the company Avco Embassy signed him and producer Deborah Hill to a two-picture deal. The first film from this contract was The Fog. Initially, the second film he was going to make was going to be The Philadelphia Experiment, which I thought was, I just learned about this doing this podcast, that they wanted him to do the book Philadelphia Experiment, which I thought was fascinating to hear about. But he rejected it in favor of his Escape from New York project. At one point during the development of the film, he kind of felt it was missing a sense of something. And he brought in his friend Nick Castle, who kind of punched it up with some comic bits. I think, a little bit of the black humor that is in the film is from Castle. I think the guys dancing in the show in New York is Castle. So Castle gave it this little crazy humor that was not there prior to his joining the production. So the setting proved to be a hell of a problem for Carpenter, who needed to create a decaying, semi-destroyed version of New York City on a shoestring budget. And he and the film's production designer, Joe Alves, rejected shooting on location in New York City because they felt it would be too hard to make it look like a destroyed city. Carp suggested shooting on a back lot, but Alves nixed the idea. He said, quote, "because the texture of a real street is not like a back lot," end quote. They sent a guy named Barry Bernardi, their location manager, on a sort of expense-paid trip across the country looking for the worst city in America. And they found East St. Louis, first of all, because it was filled with a lot of old buildings that were similar to buildings that existed in New York at the time, had a very seedy, rundown quality, and In 1976, there was a massive fire in part of the city, and they hadn't rebuilt it. So part of the city was kind of shut down and closed and vacant, and no one was living there. And they could do, you know, shots that went on for blocks with cars because it was that much real estate that was available. They also found a bridge in the area to double for what's in the film called the 69th Street Bridge, which doesn't actually exist in New York City. New York City has the 59th Street Bridge, but, you know, whatevs. The film company purchased the bridge. It's called the Old Chain of Rocks Bridge for $1 from the government, and then gave it back for the same amount once production was completed. So they wouldn't have any liability for, you know, insurance purposes when they were filming stuff on it, which I thought was very clever. And they convinced the city to shut off electricity to 10 blocks at a time at night so they could really dress sets and make it look like a decayed, burnt-out city. They shot it from August to November in 1980. Karp remembers it as a very tough, demanding shoot, saying, quote, "We'd finish shooting at about 6 a.m., and I'd just be going to sleep at 7 when the sun would come up. I'd wake up around 5 or 6 that night, depending on whether or not we had dailies, and by the time I got going, the sun would be setting. So for about 2.5 months, I never saw daylight, which was really strange." So let's start talking about the film. The first thing that happens in this movie is you hear the soundtrack, and this has got to be one of my favorite soundtracks of all time. It comes in with the credits, and it swells. Also, the font in the credits, I know this is like ridiculously detailed, but the font in the credits is like the same font that Carpenter uses in a great chunk of his films. I'm not sure when he stopped using it. There was some point when he stopped, but in most of the films in the 70s and 80s, same font, you know, kind of Woody Allen-ish in a way. The same, you know, when a film comes up that was by Karp, you know, he kind of created a little brand for himself, always titling things John Carpenter's blank and John Carpenter's this, and the font's the same, and usually started out with, you know, really eerie music. So just need to kind of, as I go back and rewatch his films, I realize that he was creating kind of a real style throughout everything. So I will talk about one scene before we start right in. There was a cut scene that took place before you sort of started in with the Liberty Island stuff. And it was of Snake robbing a bank with a partner somewhere. And it was in, this guy Mike McQuay wrote the novelization of the movie. And because, you know, when you were a kid and these movies came out, they didn't, you couldn't rent them, you know, for a while. I mean, before, you know, VCRs, they can come in for a while. And so after a movie was gone, like all you had was, you know, your memories of it. And so I was a big fan of going to get the novelization of the film just so I can relive the story. And I remember buying the Alien novelization and Raiders of the Lost Ark and The Thing and just kind of, you know, reliving these movies as I read the novelization. And sometimes the writer would be given a little more information from the creators that made it to the film. And this Mike McQuay, I did a little background. In the novelization of Escape from New York, there's also, he asks Pliskin, Bob Houck asks Pliskin when he goes into the city to try to find his son because his son is somewhere in the city. And there is a moment when Pliskin does find his son, and his son's like a complete wastrel and totally messed up and near death. And he tells Houck that he never saw him. This is kind of a little moment, which I would have loved to have made it in the film, would have made it a little more complicated. But another part of it is this early on bank robbery. So it's not too much detailed, but basically Pliskin robs a bank with a partner. They get away and they make it. And what you find out when you read about this too is that the most of a country is kind of uninhabitable because of the nerve gas from the war. So a lot of the country exists underground, and there are these extensive train arteries that run coast to coast underground. And so we have this bank robbery. I think it was in like Colorado somewhere, or maybe San Francisco. They rob the bank. They get into this train, and they think they've made it. And then, of course, they, you know, they get off or whatever their destination is in, and the police are waiting for them there. And Snake's partner is killed, and he is captured. And when you watch the scene, you know, it's kind of like, it's not a great action scene. And one thing about Escape from New York, which is really interesting when you go back and watch it, is that it's not a great action movie. It's much more of a mood piece and a really fascinating story than a crackerjack action movie. You know, like, I think as an adult, when I went back to watch it, I think I remembered that, my God, you know, Escape from New York and this incredible movie. And it, as I'll narrate as I go, it's way more of like a sci-fi mood piece than, and with a little B-movie hijinks in it. It's not super action-y, which is weird. And so Carpenter, to me, has never been the greatest action director. He's much more about mood and concept and, you know, photography, really. So Big Trouble in Little China, maybe the most action-packed movie he's ever done. But a lot of his moves, you know, his films are very moody, and Escape from New York is one of them. So when he does this bank robbery, which should be very tension-filled and action-packed, it's kind of lame. You know, it's like, it's not that great. It's like Kurt Russell walking out of a bank and with some kind of a bag, and then he walks up and he goes to a couple of elevators, and then he ends up in a train with his buddy, and it's very non-interesting. You're just like, what's going on here? And then all of a sudden he's in a train, and so you could see why it made it on the cutting room floor, because it was not a slam-bang intro to the film. Okay, so with that, we now get this voiceover, which we're back to kind of the real film. We hear a quote: in 1988, the crime rate in the United States rises 400%. We see this map of Manhattan now, and we see this wonderful idea come to life on the screen. Manhattan Island has become a prison. 50-foot containment wall was erected around the island. The bridges and waterways were mined. The United States police force, like an army, is encamped around the island, and once you go in, you never come out, which is basically it. And one little fact, the opening narration and some of the narration inside the prison when he's walking through it is none other than Jamie Lee Curtis, who's uncredited in the film. So then basically we see 1997, which is the now of the film, which is, you know, of course, very funny. One thing to remark about Escape from New York is how long it takes to actually get going. In terms of the story being something that we're invested in as a viewer, there's a lot of slow, not very interesting mood setting. I mean, it does set the mood, but it's weird. It's like, it's more like an art film mood or like a horror movie mood, which of course, you know, is Carp's forte. But we have this early shot of the city. The camera's panning up from a plaque that says New York's Maximum Security Penitentiary. There's this wonderful wall, and then what I assume is a matte painting of New York City, which looks amazing because we have the complete skyline, but it is pitch black. And then we have an opening sequence where some prisoners are trying to escape by raft and, you know, kind of paddling their way towards the wall. And we follow this helicopter that hovers over them, gives them a bit of a warning, and then fires the missiles, blows up the raft. And it's done without much fanfare and without much tension. And so then we have the only scenes that he filmed in New York, which were actually at Liberty Island. And it's a wonderful, long, slow panning shot, a helicopter, and then the Statue of Liberty, some guards standing on some of the upper ramparts, the character Remy, played by actor Tom Atkins, who's been in a couple of Carp's films. And what's interesting about this cut is that you start out in Liberty Island, and when you follow Remy into this little booth where he makes a phone call, the camera pans briefly towards a plaque and then a brief black screen. And then what you're looking at is the Sepulveda Basin in California, which is really the set of the film, which is supposed to be the Liberty Island control. But, you know, it's that Sepulveda Basin where Cameron filmed a lot of the Terminator stuff as well, you know, where the river runs out, this man-made series of culverts and basins in Los Angeles. And it's, again, very slow. Everything's very matter-of-fact now. You know, it's just very mood-setting. It's night. The camera finally tracks a bus containing, you know, a prisoner we don't know yet, gets out. He's wearing an eye patch. Of course, it's Snake. And Kurt Russell does look great, actually, in this. He looks tough and strong, but without being, like, super caught up. You know, just, like, it's a nice mix of kind of regular-looking dude who looks kind of mean. I think he still looks good even now, you know, even though we've been action movie to death since this movie came out, but he looks great. And then there's a pretty good sequence where they do this Steadicam shot where they're right in front of Snake and two guards flanking him, and he's marching, you know, very intently down the hallways and turning left and turning right. It's a great shot, although, you know, again, I think what part of this film, too, is that it's very undercooked, and that there are moments when I think Carpenter really could have pushed it a little bit and got a little bit of heightened drama out of things, but he doesn't. And this is one of them where you've got Snake kind of walking down this hallway in this very intense way, and you don't know anything about him yet. And it's very much like, what's going on? You know, it's an odd moment of the tone of this walk is something that normally would be something that would generate a little tension or a little excitement. And I don't know, it's odd where it comes in the movie. But it looks great. And, it's, you know, Carpenter with his wonderful anamorphic widescreen, everything just looks so cool. We hear this great thing where the voiceover narration is actually happening in the prison, is that if you elect to terminate your life, you will be cremated on the premises, right? So we have this very intense scene of him marching, and then he stops and turns to look at someone off screen, and we hear, hold it, and we fade out. It's really weird. And he did a bunch of these cuts when he did The Thing. He's very similar. There are times when he would almost cut a scene too early, and it wouldn't make sense that the scene was over, that the scene didn't have a point. I feel like in this scene, something else had to kind of happen. Some information had to happen or some dialogue had to happen before he cut it, but he just kind of cuts it early, and it always felt weird to me. So now we get a little bit of the beginning of the plot. We're still just kind of meandering along, very, you know, easygoing. We follow Remy over to a limo, and out pops Lee Van Cleef in all his awesomeness as Bob Houck. We hear that there's a small jet in trouble closing fast. And so we finally get inside the control room. We hear that the jet's call sign is David 14. They put it into the computer, but it doesn't come up, so they don't know who it is. Remy says, well, we've telexed Washington, but we haven't heard back yet. And then we hear some audio from the jet, and we hear someone announcing. And obviously, I mean, this is 1981, actually, when there was a lot of terrorism going on in the 70s. So it's not that it's so prescient in terms of a plane hijacked and crashed into the, you know, into buildings in New York City. But there was actually a lot of terrorism in the 70s, so it was kind of its time as well. We get a little bit of the spiel of the woman who's taking control of the jet, and then this wonderful moment comes in when the computer decodes David 14, and it says Air Force One, and it blinks, and then the music kicks in, and finally, you know, like 8-10 minutes in, and we're finally cooking now, you know, like we've got a story in front of us. So then we have our brief shot on the plane, and we meet another. This movie is peppered with fantastic performers. Donald Pleasance as the president, and he is a Carpenter regular. So we get the brief thing of that, you know, the woman has pressurized the cabin, they can't get in, and they know the plane has been completely hijacked. So we are introduced to this cool idea of the pod, and then the back of this plane, there is this orange pod with the presidential seal on it, and it's, you know, something that I guess gets ejected from the plane with a parachute. So the president can survive in case of something like this happening. Very cool, you know. One thing about Escape from New York that's great is you're continuously coming up against just cool ideas in one form or another as you go. They clapped a little life signs bracelet around him, and we see it kind of inside the pod, the life signs readout sort of come on, and so it kind of turns itself on. They close him in it, and we cut away. Then we have this great thing where we're in the control booth, and we're watching the plane via kind of a computer simulation, you know, at circa 1981. But it's cool, you know, and there's enough tension. We're also cutting back and forth to a camera that's acting as the plane's point of view. It's heading in towards New York. And it really is kind of neat when the plane impacts, the computer simulation kind of disintegrates, and we see this little dot arc down to the ground. So he was able to kind of do a plane crash without spending a shit ton of money on it. In a very kind of, these are B-movie chops, you know, it's like figuring out a way to do something that you don't have to spend tons of money on, but it's going to get across what you need to get across. So I thought this was kind of clever. You know, had this been an A Hollywood movie, you'd have to do the plane crash, and it would have to be spectacular and a lot of explosions and a lot of money up on the screen, but hey, Karp gets away with it. So then we get our first incursion onto the island, and man, this is the East St. Louis set, and it's so great. I mean, all the shots in New York, in you know, the New York of the film, are just so moody and real. I mean, they're just so realistic. It reminds me so much Walter Hill, The Warriors. Very similar sense, real sense of, you know, this is taking place on real streets. And so Karp loves helicopters. They're in, you know, Escape from New York. They're in, Members of Invisible Man a lot. They're in The Thing. And, you know, this team of choppers heads in, and we, you know, take our time, and we hear the sound of the blades, and very visceral. And the streets are wet, so they reflect the light. It's so great. There's burning cars, fires burning in garbage cans, and, you know, he's got this real low synthesizer pad playing underneath everything, really getting you into this incredible mood. Houck gets to the pod. It's empty. And then, out of nowhere, we hear this really eerie laugh, and we meet Romero, played to amazing effect by this guy, Frank Doubleday, who was the main bad guy in Assault on Precinct 13. So another Karp actor who he'd used previously. And Romero's just great. He's just this blown out psychopath with this crazy hair. He basically saunters up to Houck and flips open something from his vest, and it's the finger cut off of the president with the presidential ring and seal right on there. Just a clever idea of to convey information visually without having to have a lot of talk. And there's a great moment when his men, what do you want? And he's like, you know, you're not in the air in 20 minutes, 20 seconds, he dies. 19, 18, and he won't answer any other questions. And so Halkin, all his men run away, and Romero looks at them and he goes, and he looks at just a great, creepy character. So we cut right back to Liberty Island. Hauk gets permission from, there's now a governmental aide there, and they call the vice president, and he gets permission to try a rescue. And then we cut immediately to Hauk's office, where we have the first confrontation of Bob Hauk and Snake Plissken. And man, Van Cleef is so great. I mean, he holds his own. And I think Kurt Russell's Snake is a really terrific performance and a really terrific character. But man, you know, Hauk can totally hold his own on screen. Of course, the great Lee Van Cleef can do it. To Kurt Russell's own admission, he was kind of channeling his best Clint Eastwood, but he does it pretty well. And some great dialogue here, some great sci-fi dialogue. And William Gibson was very much influenced by this scene in particular, thinking about, you know, before he wrote Neuromancer, where we hear, you know, we don't know really anything about the world yet, but in one line of throwaway dialogue, when Bob Hauk is talking about his war service, he's like, you got two Purple Hearts, Leningrad, and Siberia. Right away, I mean, an entire world of like the U.S. and the Soviet Union are at war. And later on, when he says, you flew the Gulfire over Leningrad, like, holy cow. In the novelization of the movie, it was a classic 70s paranoia mission. Snake was part of a mission to go rescue some high-level spook that had gotten taken prisoner. And he goes in with his whole team. They get wiped out. They barely get out with the guy, and the guy actually gets killed. And they find out later that the guy wasn't real. He was a plant to give false information, and that the mission to go out and get him was a complete setup to just make his false information look authentic. So the mission never worked in the first place, as the Soviets were never fooled into believing for one second that the guy was real. So the whole thing was a classic, like, Vietnam-ish clusterfuck. Adds a little bit when you're reading the novelization, just adds a little bit to why Snake is kind of so jaded and anti-authoritarian, because a shit like that happened in his past, you know. So anyway, kind of interesting. So they're great. You know, it's a great dialogue back and forth. You know, president of what? That's not funny, Plissken. You know, call me Snake. And finally, it's, you know, very, very, this is a very lean and mean story machine, and it's great. He basically takes the amnesty and he agrees to it. And then we get a brief sort of weapons arming moment, which this great soundtrack cues underneath it. And they give him all his guns and all the things that he's going to wear. And we hear a little bit from Remy what it's like on the inside. That, you know, they trade anything. They usually converted steam engines for power because there's no electricity. And then we hear about the crazies, who are night raiders, only come out at night, which we'll meet, you know, in a little bit. Just great. The widescreen really opens this up and makes this scene look really cool. And as the weapons are kind of scrolling across the screen, we're getting ready for the mission. You know, we're given so much information here, too. He's given the tracer with the safety catch, which, you know, it's about the easiest. Later on in the film, there's a moment when the tracer is activated and they know it's Snake, because only Snake knew about the safety catch. But when you look at him actually engaging the safety catch, it's like the easiest thing that anyone in the world could possibly find. So it's a little goofy, but, you know, we love it anyway. He's given a homing device that homes in on this vital signs bracelet that the president is wearing, so he can at least track the guy to start when he gets into the prison. And so then we get another wonderful idea, as they keep coming at us in the film, is of the explosive capsules in his arteries and the life clock. So, you know, they program these things, and he doesn't know anything about it, that he thinks he's getting like an injection of like an antiviral, antitoxin, 24 hours. And then the guy giving the injection is like, tell him. So wonderful setup. You know, obviously, Hauk knows that he's going to take the glider and bail, and he needs a way to keep him reined in. And so Snake attacks him briefly, and then the wonderful line, when I get out, I'm going to kill you. And Hauk is, the Gulfire's waiting. You know, just good, tough guy, B-movie stuff. It's awesome. And we hear briefly about something called the Hartford Summit. The president was on his way there. And in 22 hours, China and the Soviets go home. So we realize that, you know, the whole world is at war, probably. We don't know if China's at war with the Soviet Union or they're both at war with us. Who knows? But we get a line, if you've been following Lee Van Cleef's career, a line you would never think ever that Lee Van Cleef would utter in his life, where he says, you know, there's a cassette tape that has to reach the summit in 22 hours. And Snake says, what's on it? And Hauk goes, you know anything about nuclear fusion? It's just great. So for anyone who's interested in the novelization, what's on the tape is proof that the Americans have found a way to detonate a warhead with a similar destructive power to a nuclear blast, but with absolutely zero radioactive fallout. And so the tape is the scientific explanation of actually how it works to prove to the China and Soviets that you know, in a sense, the U.S. would have no compunction now of completely nuking all of them, destroying their civilizations, because there would be no radiation and no fallout, and there would kind of be no, you know, which is the big mutually assured destruction thing about nuclear weapons is, first of all, we'd wipe each other out, but second, we'd irradiate the world and it would make most of it uninhabitable. So a little unknown factoid that he's, you know, about to deliver proof that they have a non-fallout fusion bomb, as it were. So then we get the glider sequence and the music playing. It's a synthesized version of Engulfed Cathedral by Claude Debussy, and it's just beautiful. The whole sequence is beautiful and quiet. He gets in the glider, and it's this really cool scene. He's backlit by this red light. Very cool looking, very futuristic. As he pilots the glider into the city, the three screens are basically displaying these wireframe animations. And what appears on the screens was not computer generated. Carpenter wanted high-tech computer graphics, which were way too expensive at the time. So to get the same effect, the effects crew filmed a miniature model set of New York City using reflective tape placed along all the edges of the buildings. But only the tape is visible and not the buildings underneath. And it appears to be a 3D wireframe animation, which I thought, you know, again, it's Carp with his B-movie, you know, hijinks and creativity. Like, and it looks great, you know, like, it probably looks better than if you would have done 3D computer animation of the time. To me, it doesn't date. When I see this scene now and he's in the glider and it still looks really good, it's because they're filming actual reflective tape. So very neat. So it's a cool kind of approach sequence. The glider's flying in and around New York. No real tension, but it's very quiet. And we've got the, you know, Engulfed Cathedral playing underneath it, and we see the graphics. Like, it's a mood piece. He's really setting the mood here of a quiet incursion into this, you know, nutty prison at night, you know. So it's really, I think, it's very successful in that way. And there's a brief bit of tension when he has to land, you know, and we're thinking a drop-off in 10 feet, 5 feet, 0 feet, and he has to use this anchor that he ejects from the back of the plane to stop it right from the edge. So he is in. So one thing I've always wondered, where he rips off a power box at the top floor and activates the elevator, and I thought there was no power in the entire city except for what they could use when, you know, people convert steam, crude steam generating devices, and yet there's power at the Trade Center. So I can never quite figure that out, and why they needed it. I mean, I wonder if they thought that him walking down 110 stories and then back up 110 stories was too much for the story. But I don't know. It's just an odd little nit in this. There's a great moment when he gets to the 50th floor and he's calling Hauk on the radio, telling him that he's almost there. And as he's hanging up the radio, a figure runs really fast from cover to cover behind Snake. He doesn't notice it. And there's a crazy soundtrack cue that's like, meow. Complete horror movie moment that really is freaky. It still kind of works to this day. So now we've got more mood setting. Snake gets to the ground and he's walking through the neighborhood. Man, it looks so good. And the crash site is really great, actually. This has got some scope to it. There are parts of what looks like a downed airliner, really big in the frame. Kind of an epic shot at night. Fires burning from all over the place. You know, definitely to me, it really felt like a airliner crash zone. Fires burning all over the place and a broken up plane, this huge tail fin sticking up and Snake's walking next to it. So while he's here, he gets a read on the president's vitals briefly and moves off in pursuit.
This is the 24th century. Material needs no longer exist.
Ah, Captain, but they still exist in the 21st century, unfortunately. I'd like to tell you a few ways that you could contribute to Sci-Fi on Screen if you'd like. If you really enjoy the show, I'd really appreciate the support. And one of the great ways you can contribute is via a site called Patreon.com. Patreon's P-A-T-R-E-O-N. And the great thing about Patreon is you sign up and you decide how much you'd like to contribute per podcast. You set it and you forget it. And the good thing is you only get debited if I record and upload a show. So it's not like you're going to be giving me money month after month and I decide not to do any shows. It's what I like about it. It keeps me honest, and you don't contribute if I don't produce. So I highly encourage you, if you'd like to support the show, please go to patreon.com and look for Sci-Fi on Screen. You can also find the button that takes you right there on the website, scifionscreen.com. If you want to do a one-time donation, you can go to PayPal and use the email scifionscreen, all one word, at gmail.com if you'd like to do that. I always appreciate when you share the shows on Facebook and when you retweet them, write a review on iTunes, any way you can get the word out, link it to Reddit, any other cool way that you think of that you can get some folks to check out the show. And I just want to remind folks that on my website, I have a page that is an alphabetized archive of every movie that I've done as a podcast, so you can just go and there's a letter alphabet and go to your, whatever one you're looking for. Easy to navigate. And you can click on it and it takes you right to the podcast that you're looking for.
Gonna crack my knuckles and jump for joy. I got a clean bill of health from Dr. McCoy.
So Snake follows the Tracer into the most bizarre, drag show we've ever seen in a post-apocalyptic setting. We get a sense of, the camera shows us the show a bit, and we see Ernest Borgnine, who's another casting coup in a film full of amazing actors. Cabby sees Snake kind of go into a side room, and he follows him, and we get the first instance of the "I thought you were dead, I heard you were dead" trope that goes throughout this movie. And there's some really creepy tension as the Steadicam follows Snake downstairs, and it's soundless, and he wanders through this pitch dark area. And what Carpenter said is that the lenses he were using were super fast, so he didn't need a lot of light. So it's kind of similar to what Kubrick did, Barry Lyndon, where he got these super fast NASA lenses so he could film, not completely by candlelight, but close enough. Carp said he did the same thing here, and you can tell in some of the scenes that most of the light, who knows? I'm sure they cheat in some ways that we can't really tell. But boy, it really, really feels like the only light we're getting in some scenes are from, burning trash cans, which just looks great. And there's our first little action fight scene here. It's very brief. Two people try to sneak up on Snake, and he bashes them both in the face from behind. And it looks cool. He does it in a very badass way. And there's this group of people that are dancing to no music, and they stripping this woman and about to rape her. And I love that he walks on and doesn't try to save her, he is an anti-hero, he's not a good guy, right? And finds this sodded old drunk who has the president's vital signs bracelet on it, and calls it into Hauk, and tells him. There's a brief tension moment when he smashes the bracelet, and Hauk and the men back at the mission base are like, maybe it was just an impact on the mechanism itself, and he's not dead. So Snake pleads, that's it. And then, president's dead, mission's over. And Hauk, of course, is like, I'll burn you off the wall. I want the tape and the president back. And so he has to continue on. Again, more mood setting. He goes back outside. He's sitting on an old chair near the wreckage, no idea what to do. First, we get this figure slowly moving in the background. And because it's this anamorphic, I guess when you shoot anamorphically, you have a very shallow depth of focus. So we see in a blurry back focus this figure running, and then the camera focuses from Snake now into a distance to this figure. And we see this figure bang on the sewer grates with the crowbar. We sort of know what it is before Snake does. And this really creepy music cue as the crazies start to come out of the, and they're running past Snake, and the shadows are, flipping up on the sides of the buildings being thrown by the fires. It just looks so great. I mean, the more I was watching this again for the umpteenth time, the more I was like, boy, this is really just a mood. It's such the most moody apocalyptic film that I've ever seen, Snake goes into what used to be, the Starbucks of yore, chock full of nuts, I guess was a very famous coffee store in New York City in the late 70s and early 80s. So they dressed a St. Louis, I guess, place to double a chock full of nuts. He sneaks in to hide from the crazies. He goes in the back and he meets some woman played by an actor named Susan Hubley, who was Russell's wife at the time. And she delivers the information that it's the crazies. It's the end of the month. They're out of food. So, you know, they're basically cannibals out looking for people to eat. We get the heard you were deadline here, you know, and there's this moment where she's coming on to him, you know, when you get out of here, you're going to take me with you. And then basically the floor erupts around them both and she's taken down by the crazies, gone in like a second. And so there's kind of some nice action movie stuff where he has to kind of run for a while and he climbs up a building. He uses this automatic weapon to sort of, you know, he shoots like a man-sized kind of hole in the wall and then jumps through and kind of comes down in this alley. And then we steady cam with him down the alley, which just looks so cool. And at the end of the alley, up pulls Cabby playing a very famous song called Bandstand Boogie by Artie Shaw, which we will hear, I think, one or two more times before the end of the film. He gets in the back. Okay, going my way, buddy. Snake gets in the back seat. As the crazies are heading for the cab, Cabby very relaxedly takes a Molotov cocktail, lights it, heaves it up through the moonroof. It blows up and they drive off. And again, you know, Ernest Borgnine, just wonderful as Cabby, just wide-eyed and crazy. And we hear from Cabby that the president is being held by a character named the Duke. Everyone knows the Duke is the Duke of New York. He's A-1. First time we hear that. At this point, you know, Cabby was willing to take him to see someone who knows where, how to get to the president. We don't know who it is yet, but he's like, take me to him. He's like, I'll take you to someone who knows how to get there. And off they go. So again, even after this brief action sequence, you know, one thing I definitely get when I rewatch this film is really that it's very undercooked in a lot of ways, and that this zombie action, you know, the crazies action sequence was, you know, he didn't really have too much trouble getting away, and we were never really worried about him too much. It was very kind of easy for him to do what he did, and he was never in that much distress. And I'm not one to really overclock stuff and want it really over the top, but it was a little too easy. So the tension that Karp uses is very dated. It's definitely not thriller action movie tension, but the mood and the place setting of the film, to me, still, as I can watch it, make up for it. And it's still extremely watchable. I mean, dystopian films never looked this real, I think, before this movie came out. You had, I think, in the next year was The Road Warrior, even Omega Man back in the early 70s. Like, nothing looked this gloomy and creepy and wasted before, you know, and this well-photographed to boot. Then we get two more great character actors. We get Brain, played by the great Harry Dean Stanton, and Maggie, played by the ever-awesome Adrian Barbeau. Brain lives at the New York Public Library. They won't let him in. And then Cabby mentions his name, and his name is like, you know, a password in this crazy prison. So he knows Brain from a previous life, you know, basically back out in the world. Brain had left him during a job at some point, and he tells Snake he relates. Snake's like, you know, you left me in Fresno, Bob. You know what they did to Bob? So he's threatening to kill him. And, you know, Brain kind of feels like he has cause because he kind of did betray him back in the day. And then we hear about the plan that the Duke has for the president and that he's going to, you know, put him on his car and they're going to drive across what they call in this film, which I don't know why they make it the 69th Street Bridge and not the 59th Street Bridge, which is a real bridge, you know? It's weird. But the idea is that, you know, they're going to take him across the 69th Street Bridge, and Brain has gotten a map of where all the mines are that somebody made. I guess this is someone crawled up through the bridge and made a map where all the mines are so that these cars can thread through the mines with the president, and they're going to go out the next day. You know, basically amnesty for all prisoners and escape. But he tells him about the glider, and basically, you know, at gunpoint convinces Brain to go along with it. They all leave. They see the Duke's entourage. Basically, Duke's coming to Brain to, who knows, probably get the map at that point. But, you know, what we hear is that Brain makes gas for him. He figures out stuff for him, like he's a really smart guy. And the Duke's car has these great chandeliers hanging from the hood. It's very cool looking. And we see the Duke for the first time, played by the great Isaac Hayes, another casting coup. Like, he did no wrong casting this movie, in my book. In some tension sequence, they steal one of the Duke's cars. They go up Broadway, and, you know, before they get to Broadway, we hear Maggie say, we can't take Broadway, Brain, not Broadway. Oh, but it's got 5 minutes on the Duke. So they're in a race to get back to the Duke's place to get the president before he gets there. And we hear this one throwaway line. from Snake, "What's Wrong with Broadway?" as they're driving by. And on the side of the road is a stick with a guy's head cut off and put on the top of it. So, great moment. And you know what I realized in repeated viewings of this film is that Ridley put female action heroes on the map with Sigourney Weaver. And then Cameron later in 84, I believe, with Terminator. But you had Maggie here. And Maggie was kind of like a prototypical female action hero. You know, she was Brain's girlfriend. But she was the one who knew how to handle weapons, and in the end, she gives her life for him. So it was interesting to see that, you know, Carpenter's also doing, you know, he had Snake as the protagonist, but Maggie was sort of like this female action hero as well. So I feel like she's part of a great trio of Ripley, Maggie, and then Linda Hamilton as Sarah Connor, you know, like the three seminal female action heroes of the early part of the 80s. So, you know, we basically get a kind of a sneak around sequence when, you know, and Snake gets the president out of this railroad car, but they're taken and Snake gets an arrow in the leg. He throws a throwing star at a guy's forehead, so we see him use some kind of hand-to-hand weaponry. They don't get far, and then we have this confrontation between the Duke and Snake, and it's great. Snake doesn't say shit, and the Duke says very little. And when they close up on Isaac Hayes' face, he's got a slight twitch to his cheek and his eye. Like, it's really, really good, minimal kind of tough guy character acting. And Romero's great. Romero's prancing around, pointing at the Duke as if he were his jester, which he kind of is. And, you know, of course, this scene ends with him saying, "I've heard of you." And then he clubs him with the crowbar. And he's like, "I heard you were dead." Boom, we're out. Then we get this sequence of, they put the president up against a wall, and the Duke has taken one of Snake's guns and is target practicing. And we have this moment of the Duke has taught the president how to address him, you know, and Donald Pleasance first mumbles it, you know, and then the second time he shouts it, "You're the Duke of New York, you're A number 1. There's this tension between Brain and the Duke because Snake had said something that the president was, you know, kind of booby-trapped in an offhand way, and Brain's told him to his face that you're kind of bullshitting. But now Brain kind of believes it, and he tells the Duke, you know, there's something up with the president, and don't kill Pliskin, we need him, and all this kind of crap. So basically the Duke turns his gun on Brain, and he's like, "Go get the map and, you know, shut the hell up." And in one last shot, he shoots open the briefcase, which has been chained to the president's wrist, and Romero saunters up and puts the cassette, which will come in handy later, in his pocket. And we see all that. Now there's this moment where they wave down some choppers. I guess that there are food drops here, and I'm not sure how this kind of happened, but they wave some choppers down. The choppers come down in this, you know, this open area, probably near one of the rivers. And what you're seeing there is James Cameron's glass painting of New York City. Cameron was in the art department on this film, and Karp also says he was also director of photography. You know, he did some of the photographing here. So, you know, the genesis of Jim Cameron, who would go on a few years later to make The Terminator, that he came out of Roger Corman's shop and, you know, worked with John Carpenter on Escape from New York. So really cool that, you know, you're seeing some James Cameron work in this film. The chopper picks up the briefcase, which the Duke had given. And now back, you know, with Bob Houck, they open up the briefcase. We get the written demands that they're going to drive across the bridge at noon the next day. Amnesty for all prisoners in exchange for the president. And inside the briefcase is a set of goggles that Snake had with him as part of his equipment, with two nails sticking out. So the political guy from D.C. is sort of like, "So much for your man, Houck." And, you know, Houck's not sure, but he starts to warm up the choppers because basically now they're left with no choice but to go in strong and try to get the president back. So we cut back to Brain's place, and he's trying to figure out where Snake brought the glider in, and he figures it out quite on his own, World Trade Center. So we get a sense that Brain and Maggie now are going to try to do what Snake did and betray the Duke and get the president out on their own. So then we get the great battle between Snake and this massive wrestler whose name in real life was Ox Baker. And before that, we get a brief, great speech by Isaac Hayes. You know, "They sent in their best man, and we're going to show them their best man." And he basically, you know, he's going to cut off Snake's head and put it on the hood of his car when they roll up the street the next day. You know, keeping things real. Like, one thing that's still pretty real here is that they're pretty crazy, and I do get a sense of menace and danger from the gangs and the crazies and all the individuals on the island. You know, like, it doesn't feel dated in a way that they're toothless. They all seem pretty nuts and pretty out of their minds, and so that kind of, to me, I don't know, that stays with me still even now, which is kind of cool. So then they have this fight, and the fight's okay. You know, it's basically 1981, so what was fight choreography back then? They start out with bats, they graduate to bats with nails in them and shields. One little bit of trivia is that this guy Ox Baker that they found to do this wasn't going easy on Kurt Russell. Kurt Russell, time and time again, was saying, hey, man, you got to ease up, because he was going full blast on the guy, and he's huge. And at one point, John Carpenter relates that Kurt Russell kind of hit him in the balls rather, not so gently, and basically put it to him like, you know, back off, and Ox back down. So this is kind of a funny story. The second time when you think Snake's got it, he kind of gets him in the gut with, and then right in the head. It was a great last shot when he just like smacks it into the back of the guy's head, and the whole place goes silent. And then immediately they start chanting Snake. So in a sense, Snake has kind of graduated by beating this guy. Now he's kind of now allowed to go unmolested within the rest of this group, which is, I thought, kind of a cool thing, actually. Kind of like I don't think a modern movie would let him off that easy, but I thought it was kind of neat that that was able to happen. He lost two pieces of equipment, which one of them was on Ox Baker, and the other one was on the guy who was at the ring hitting the bell. And Ox has his life clock, which he brings back. And, you know, we've been looking at the life clock the whole movie, which is just a genius part of the plot, that whenever we look at this thing, like, if he's not back by the time it hits zero, he's dead meat. So the life clock's a great plot device, I think. And then the guy who was hitting the round bells had the tracer. So he grabs him and he pushes the tracer button, and immediately Hauk winds up standing down. And then, you know, there's the line here that's a little goofy now when you think about it. It's like, only Pliskin knew there was a safety catch. But when you watched him earlier pop the safety catch, it was like, you know, the safety catch in a kid's toy. Like, you know, pretty much anybody could have discovered it, as it were. But anyway, it's part of the story and you kind of go with it. Then there's a scene of Bran and Maggie taking the president, and he kills Romero by stabbing him, and it's kind of a great death. Romero just kind of exhales, and Maggie kills three of Romero's henchmen in the room with wonderfully well-placed shots. Like, it's Maggie's best badass moment in the movie, where Bran stabs Romero, and it's like, boom, 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 the other three are down, and Maggie's sort of like, you know, smiling. Perfect shot, so it's great. Made me think of Trinity Neo in a way. Bran and Maggie are at the World Trade Center. Snake knows that's where he's going to probably go, so he's there. And a gang has preceded them there, and they're fighting on top of the World Trade Center. And this gang cuts the tow cable of the glider, which then spirals out of control, falls off the roof, and it's out of action. And they have to go all the way back down to ground level. And this, when they get back down to the ground level where the Bran parked his car, doesn't start, you know, so they go around to the front and they open it up, and a guy with a crossbow emerges, and we hear Isaac Hayes off to the side, car trouble? And he's, you know, sitting next to the still running steam engine, you know, which is has been taken out of the car just for the sake of being cool, you know, when Snake got down to ground level. We get a little bit of action movie moment here where Snake's faster on the draw than the Duke is, and he shoots the engine, which sprays out the superheated steam, and sort of they all get away. And so then we have this last chase on the bridge, which is actually a pretty good chase even now. It doesn't last very long, and it's very clear what's happening. And, you know, the mines on the bridge and having them weave in and out of the cars. It's kind of cool in that they're, you know, they're ahead of the Duke. At one point, Snake doesn't move as fast as his Bran wants him to, so the cab blows in half. Cabby dies. And then they're on foot running, and the bridge looks great. I mean, I don't doubt for a minute that they're on a real bridge. You know, it's another really great set design. It doesn't feel fake to me. At one point, Bran runs in a different direction than the rest of them, and he steps right on a mine, killed immediately. And then there's a great scene between Maggie and Snake, where Snake's like, Maggie, he's gone. And she doesn't even say anything. She holds out her hand, and Snake throws her the gun and keeps running with the president. But before we got that, Bran knew where the tape was. So when they got out of the World Trade Center, because Bran betrayed him, Snake was basically like, you're out. But the tape is missing, and Bran knows where it is. And of course, we're in the car with Cabby, We get the American Bandstand tape, and then Snake plugs in the President's tape, and we hear this dry voice say, "The discovery of the tritium produces 1/1000th of the biological," you know, and it cuts. So Snake now has the tape, and he's got the President, and now he's heading for the wall. And then there's a pretty decent scene where, you know, we're kind of close up on Maggie, and she's just firing directly at the Duke's vehicle. I think she gets off 7 shots, and it's a 6-shooter, but, you know, I'm nitpicking. But the Duke runs right into her, kills her, but he crashes his car because of it, and now he's on foot. And the wall looks great. They finally get to the wall at the end of the bridge. It looks really good. President is winched up first. Snake's looking at his life clock, 1:32 to go. He jumps on, and then the President holds it, and we get, you know, Donald Pleasance, probably his best action movie moment in his entire career, where he takes an automatic weapon and basically mows the Duke down. "You're the Duke, you know, you're a number one." And he has his moment of rage and domination. Finally, Snake gets over the wall. And there's some good tension here because the life clock is almost up. He's got seconds. And he's about to go to Cronenberg with the machine. And Hauk steps in front of him and says, "The tape, Pliskin." Gives him the tape, does the thing at the neck, and it's over. And then there's a brief coda where the President's sort of, you know, getting shaved, and they're giving him a suit, and he's going to broadcast from there and broadcast the tape and do everything he's supposed to do. And, you know, the President's like, "Anything you want." Snake's like, "I just want one question. A lot of people died getting you out. I wonder how you felt about it." And we see that the scene is a setup for Snake to see what a, you know, what a bullshit piece of crap the President is. And, "Oh, the nation appreciates their sacrifice, and I want to thank them." And for me, I sort of look at his Snake sort of like, you know what, you're not really a human being, you're a douchebag. And maybe he would have given him the real tape had he been penitent about it, or had he had some real human feeling about it. Maybe that was his moment to, like, to be a human being, and Snake really is like, "Nah, you're kind of a douchebag, I'm not giving you the tape." So he's walking away. We get the one, the great line where Hauk offers him a job, and he finally uses Snake. The name's Pliskin. Snake walks off into the night. And then we get the wonderful coda, the President saying, you know, "I offer this in the hope that our nations can live in peace." And of course, it's the Bandstand music that blares out into the night. We hear the moody soundtrack come up, and we see Snake pull out another tape from his pocket and light it with a cigarette and rip it apart and walk off into the night like the anti-hero that he is. And we are out. So, Escape from New York, just, you know, brief summary. I've said most of what I want to say about it. This movie had an incredible impact on me as a kid. It really was kind of responsible for getting me into science fiction film. I was reading books before that, you know, and there was Star Wars, obviously, but this was a whole new thing. To me, my childhood is kind of like a combination of Star Wars and Escape from New York, where Star Wars was the first thing, and then a little echo of Star Wars, Battlestar Galactica. And, you know, a lot of the science fiction in the 70s was still very optimistic sci-fi. We weren't doing heavy dystopia yet. And then Escape from New York is the other side of it, sort of the darker side. And the really incredible sense of dystopia, to me, that it spawned. I mean, in a weird way, Neuromancer came not soon after that, also very dystopic, when things took a real grim turn in sci-fi. You know, there was always dystopia in sci-fi, but I feel like in the 80s, man, it got dark for a while and stayed that way for a while. In film and in you know, and in written form. So I can still go back and watch this film as a mood piece. How wonderful it's shot, and I love the soundtrack. To me, the soundtrack and all the sound work make it such an experience to watch on a really good quality, you know, TV if you can find it. You know, if you could go out to a revival theater to see it, so much the better. Carpenter's widescreen vistas. Every time I'm on the streets in New York, it's a scary, dangerous, and very real place. It always looks great. All of the actors are amazing. Everyone's cast perfect. I mean, Adrian Barbeau, Isaac Hayes, Kurt Russell, Lee Van Cleef, Harry Dean Stanton, Ernest Borgnine. You know, my God, you know, like, what an incredible cast. It suffers a little from B-movie-itis, you know, like, it's not the strongest film in terms of, like, dialogue and character. It's really kind of like a teenage boy's cool, even when you see it now. But the concept is almost foolproof. Like, it's a foolproof plot. I can't believe that they haven't remade it after all these years, frankly. I mean, I wonder if Carpenter's holding on to the rights until someone really cool comes along, because it's a crackerjack story that can be remade a zillion times. I mean, how do you blow it? You know, like, it's perfect. But it's a little undercooked when I see it now. You know, we've gotten so sophisticated in our kinetic pop art, as I like to call movies that I like to watch. And so this is a little less. It's a little more mood and sound and concept and just kind of posturing. And, you know, it's not much on action, which was a very interesting thing to go back and watch. The only bit of sequel to come out of this was the abysmal Escape from L.A. And I've tried to watch that movie several times. Sometimes I recognize that Carpenter actually tried to do something earnest. Most of the time, to me, it's like an almost unwatchable, I feel like, ridiculous, you know, my beloved Snake Plissken had a walkthrough in that movie. He's surfing the L.A. River and, oh, what a bunch of nonsense. Steve Buscemi, like, it was just really, really a terrible movie. I do not like Escape from L.A. There was talks that there was going to be an Escape from Earth as the next escalation. The Earth was going to be a backwater, and he would have to go to Earth to, you know, sort of rescue someone from Earth and get out. Same concept, but, you know, Carp should let someone else do, I think, the next iteration of Snake. And I think somebody should. This should be remade. It's such a great concept, and I think it can bear successive attempts to do it. He just wasn't able to do it himself with the sequel. And so that's all I've got to say about Escape from New York, and I will see you next time.